Okay. Today is Monday, the 12th of April, 2021. And I hope Yomo has done the best he can, that we shouldn't have a repeat of yesterday. I'm broadcasting through Yomo's phone, whatever this means. I'm just repeating words. And it was very thwarting and frustrating, and I want to thank Yomo. He worked very hard putting up the shear and getting rid of the five different times I was interrupted by the Zoom. Jack, I have your comments. I want to check out Rabbi Sarah, but I have more to say, and we'll finish off the topic next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. I dedicated yesterday's shear. As I mentioned, the last few weeks have been both wonderful and very sad for me. And yesterday I dedicated the shiur in memory of Joey Abelo, Achad Me'achabura, one of our students, one of our group, one of our intimate acquaintances. Today, sadly, I have to dedicate the shiur in memory of my neighbor of over 50 years, my chaver, my colleague, my very close friend, Sam Dershowitz. And I want to say a few words about Sam. He was a graduate of the first class of Brooklyn Talmudical Academy. I believe he graduated in 48, 49. Classmate of Meir Kahana. Yitz Greenberg, I believe, was in that class. It turned out quite a few individuals. And what impressed me about Sam, Hamushim Alu B'nei Yisrael, only one-fifth of the Jews left Egypt. And perhaps the wonder, was Egypt so wonderful that 80% remained? But it takes us back to my Divrei Torah, which I always thought was my own. Many years after I said it, I heard it from the Rav, a recording from Moria. Lech lecha miyatzecha mimoladcha mibeit avicha. You all know I've said it many times in the Kollel, the order is wrong. You leave the land last, you leave your father's house first. But as I explained, and as later I was zeichet to hear, the Rav gives this same explanation, the hardest part of leaving is leaving your father's house. In other words, to leave America, all right, we were good Americans, we were proud of America, at least America at the time that I left in 69, even though by the 60s America was shaking already with the student revolution and Woodstock, etc. Then you leave the Bronx, all right, you have a deeper connection to the Bronx than to the United States. But your father's house, it means your family, your intimate friends, the shul you daven in, etc. And not many people are big enough to do it. What always impressed me about Sam is how much adjustment he made in his life. What we can learn from it. Mental health, those of you who are psychologists know what I'm talking about. Mental health. Here's a kid who grew up in Czechoslovakia in a wealthy home. They had maids. The late, very late 30s, at the very tail end, his aunt and uncle in America get them out. They reach America. So he has to adjust from being a Czechoslovakian to be a kid growing up in Brooklyn. He goes to Tera Vidas Elementary School, and he's still friendly. They're not all alive anymore. I don't know if any are alive, with his classmates from Tera Vidas. Then he goes on to high school, BTA, YU, Rabbi Peretz Yogel, classmates, Meir Kahana, Yitz Greenberg. Very, very different than what he experienced in Tera Vidas. So then again, there's adjustment. Finishes yeshiva, and I want you to know when he graduated college, he got the Talmud Award, sharing it with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. So I think that tells you something. Then he goes to Columbia, graduate school, PhD, all right. Charlie, you should appreciate it, from Kol Torah to Harvard. It's adjustment. And then he moves to Brookline. And I have to tell you, living in Brooklyn is very different than living in Brookline, even though it's very similar, Brooklyn. It's a different world altogether. And he adjusted beautifully. He was president of the Young Israel of Brookline. And 1971, the Kamen Aliyah, Rav Berlin 18, another adjustment. He served in the army, he worked for the government, he taught in Hebrew. He had a very unique doctorate in fabric chemistry. But I have to tell you, I think later in life, he regretted everything he did. Why didn't he become a rabbi? Why do I say that? Whenever you met Sam, he had a good Dvar Torah for you, had a good insight. He quoted something from the Rav. He was in Boston many years, very close to the Rav. And on Shabbos morning, again, I daven next to someone in shul, Monty Nussbaum. To you, it's a name, Menachem Nussbaum. He opened the door in Yeshiva Solanta. He was 1 year ahead of me when I came to Solanta in 43. Monty took me in, taught me the ropes. He later was president of the student council. A year later, I was president of the student council. And Monty and I daven next to each other for 50 plus years now in Ohel Rivka. So Monty said to me, I'm very mad at Sam. I said, what do you mean you're very mad at Sam? He said, I pleaded with him, write down everything you heard from the Rav. It's a Sefer Shalem. And he never got around to it, as they say. So I have to tell you, for me, it's a personal loss. Malka and I, Barbara and Sam, were our closest neighbors, our closest friends in the building, the area. I want to dedicate this year with all my heart to the memory of Shmuel Dershowitz. He was unique, and we can all learn from his ability how to adjust, how to go from Shir HaShirim to Mishlei, from Mishlei to Kohelet, etc. Yehei Zichro Baruch. Okay, I hope I've done a little justice. It's a personal big loss. Some of the correspondence I received is absolutely fascinating. And if you recall, we spoke about, I don't know if it was this year, last year, I told you the story of the spittoons in Kehillat Yeshurun. What I'm about to tell you now is classic. And my dear Talmud, Rabbi Norman Schless, those of you who drank Coca-Cola on Pesach, you have to thank Norman Schless. He's the OU representative who goes to Ireland where they make the essence. And it's due to his Hashgacha, Benjamin, that you drank Coca-Cola on Pesach. So Norman Schless writes to me. He bunked into Rabbi Haskell Lookstein in Atlanta, visiting his children and grandchildren, my students. And he told Haki when I said in class about the spittoons. So Haki said, let me tell you something Rabbi Rothkopf doesn't know. And what he said was there was a bitter battle. One guy on the board of trustees insisted, I want one spittoon for my father. And Rabbi Lookstein said no. And they voted to get rid of all the spittoons. And one of the Balabata went over to this guy and said, I know why you're fighting for a spittoon for your father, because you're the spitting image of your father. Quote, end quote. That's a good word. And Haki is right. Arnie Roscoff did not know that story. So then I want to make a correction. And I have to tell you, if you watch me teach, if it's from my notes, I'm absolutely right. Everything I've prepared, I have researched thoroughly. But when I go off on a tangent and start speculating, I can be way off. So if you recall, I mentioned that Mike Tress and Mara Scherer were first cousins. Maybe they were named for the same grandfather. So I got a letter from, let me see who this is from, Tiskele Mitzvot, Moshe Lieberman. And Moshe Lieberman writes to me that Mike Tress's Hebrew name was Elimelech Gavriel. And he knows this because he taught Mike Tress's great-grandchild, who was named after him, and he was called Elimelech Gavriel. They were not named after the same person. So it could very well be that my guess was totally wrong, but Mike and Morris are similar, but they were first cousins. That we're certain about. My mentioning of Reb Elchanan Wasserman and Reb Simcha Wasserman, we spoke about this in the context of Torah Vadas and Torah Mesorah, brought quite a bit of response. And Ein Hachinami, I was right as far as Reb Simcha Wasserman accompanied his father to America in 1938. That's the famous visit where he refused to give his shiur at Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. And he accompanied his father, and he remained in the States. And that's how Reb Simcha's life was saved. There was one more son who survived the Holocaust, and he later got to America. That son was David Wasserman. And David Wasserman, a recent issue of Mishpacha, had a two-page insert about the son, the brother left behind. He survived the Holocaust with miracles. He only survived, and this is written between the lines, of course, Mishpacha can't say it openly, he only survived because he didn't listen to his father. What happened was, he was a yeshiva boy like everyone else, and in 1938, he decided that he needs secular education, he has to make a living, and he left to study at the University of Riga, where he got a degree in engineering. The night before he left, the Balkanen stayed up with him all night, crying, worried stiff that he would leave the Torah. Because of its engineering ability, he was valuable to the Nazis and had jobs in all the death camps that he was in that enabled him to survive. He made it out of the Holocaust. Reb Simcha brought him to America. He remained a frum Jew. And when he survived, this is fascinating, he knew that he had a brother in America. He had no idea where Reb Simcha lived. He sent a letter after World War II addressed to Rabbi Simcha Wasserman in New York City. And the letter reached Rabbi Simcha Wasserman. I remember in Israel, in my time when I came in Aliyah, they had a department in the post office to try to identify every letter, even if you would have sent a letter for the sake of argument, Aaron Rakefet Yerushalayim, they would have traced down and delivered it to 18 Berlin. And his brother brought him to America, and he remained the Shomer Torah Mitzvah. He worked in the field of engineering. And his grandson, or great-grandson, is involved now in Grow Torah, which got a grant from the OU. It's dealing with teaching children about the importance of ecology from the point of view of Torah, Lo Tashchit.
That's so, Reb Wasserman's grandson?
Great-grandson. That's the name they give here. I don't know him.
Really?
But that's the name they give. One second, I'll go back. Let me take off my glasses.
I know him well.
Minigilbo Slum Yosef Gillers.
Really? So
is the founder of Great Torah. So you know him well, Ben?
Yes.
Benjamin says he knows him well.
I've seen him for many years. Me and Ellie.
Wow. And they never knew his yichus. That's a great grandson, Reb Elchanan Wasserman. Jeff Francis in Atlanta, who knew Reb Simcha, and all the other children of Reb Elchanan were wiped out. There's a daughter, evidently, who survived, but I can't, there's no information on her as far as what became of her and whether she left or remained within the family fold. I mentioned that Reb Simcha Wasserman, went out. He was in Detroit, then he went out to the coast. He established Or Elchanan, which may have been the first yeshiva that dealt with Balei Tshuva in America. Later, I know when he couldn't administer it anymore, Elchanan was given over or sold over. It's today a Chabad institution, if I'm not mistaken. And Rabbi Francis writes, I had the experience of meeting Reb Simcha Wasserman in 1983 when I was a student in the Chabad Chaim branch high school in San Fernando Valley in California. The school you refer to is Yeshivat Or Elchanan. He was a soft-spoken, erudite, and gentle man who not only exuded gatlut b'torah, but also good humor and normalcy from every pore. to the Talmidim of Chafetz Chaim who populated our post-high school Beit Midrash and acted as mentors for us younger and pretty wild group of guys, the excitement of his arrival. He could have been the Beatles or Elvis, not only because of who he was, but of this connection to the Chafetz Chaim. We were mostly young, modern Orthodox, 1980s, teenage adolescents, and had no idea who he was or the bit deal. But the memory of meeting him and what he said and how he laughed and joked with us in talking Torah in a way we could understand, even with his long beard and hat, left an impression so many years later. And I want to tell you, sadly, a document has surfaced on the internet from the U.S. Department of Justice Immigration and Naturalization Service, January 5th, 1944. And here's a letter signed by an interesting name, Joseph Salvatore Schumacher, Assistant Commissioner. And it's allowing Reb Simcha to bring Reb Elchanan, his brother, a first-degree relative, into the United States. And of course, when that letter was written, Reb Elchanan was no longer alive, but no one knew it at the time. Okay, I just want to make one more comment. It's something I should have mentioned in class many weeks ago, but I did not. And I just want to bring you up to date. Let me just see where the email is. Right, I'm sorry, I have all these emails here, and it gets lost in the crowd. Here it is, from Dr. Zismore. One correction, Rabbi Ephraim Wolf was not rabbi in Woodmere. He was rabbi in the Great Neck Synagogue. It's a small correction. I confused them. I know who I confused them with, and they both had a somewhat similar background. However, what is interesting is that Tera Vidas, when it began the high school, it didn't begin its own high school. The boys traveled by subway into the Lower East Side, and they went to, took high school classes at Talmudical Academy. In other words, not all the high school classes were given at Tera Vidas, at the Matifta, but when it began, they took advantage of the well-organized Talmudical Academy. Obviously, later in the 20s, as Talmudic Academy gets prepared to move uptown by the end of 1928, Tera Vidas, you can't send boys from Brooklyn to Washington Heights, and Tera Vidas organizes its own total independent high school program, which continues until today. If I'm not mistaken, that is mentioned in the 100th anniversary coffee table book about Tera Vidas, that they began the high school taking advantage of the classes of the high school of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. At that time, it was not yet Yeshiva University, so they can mention part of Reitz. They can get away with it in Brooklyn of today. Okay. Now I want to go back to where we left off and continue, and it's a lot of fascinating material. For me personally, many of the names I mentioned, I knew some of them I knew quite well, not just that I knew to shake hands with them. And these people built Torah in the United States. Rabbi Revel was the first one. He dreamt about day schools. But like everything else in life, you have to have time, you have to have peace of mind. I just saw a criticism of the Rav that he never wrote what he planned in 44, the halachic mind. He's going to write an entire philosophic treatise on the halacha as the basis of Jewish philosophy. All right, if the Rav would have written that, it would have been a gift for Dore Dorot. But you get involved, you move sideways, and you have other cares and pressures. Life doesn't work out so easily. I saw Rav Shmuel Hirsch also in his youth had great plans, and I believe it was And one of the volumes that JPS put out about Rav Shmuel Fol Hirsch told there was criticism, he didn't achieve it. Whoever criticizes is foolish because life has its curveballs, its screwballs, its fastballs, etc. It's not always a bag of roses, a bunch of roses. So Rabbi Rebel had the vision, but the man had no mazel. The minute yeshiva opened, the great crash, the depression, he has $3 million worth of pledges, and they say it's not worth the paper they were written on. So the last 12 years of his life were not easy, not happy, and ultimately he died young. He was all of something like 85 to 40. He was 55 years old when he died. Mr. Mendelovich had tremendous skliyot. He built MTV, Teira Vidas, but it pales by comparison, and you'll see, I'll quote him saying it, it pales by comparison what he achieved with his vision of Torah and Mesorah. And here he had mazel that the vision could come to fruition. It was the right time, the right place. He recognized you have to have day schools all over. He recognized you have to have teachers who know how to teach. Now remember, a teacher can make or break you. When you read memoir literature, you will find that time and again, I don't have to go further than Washington. A guy named Rakefet, he pays homage to his teachers because they inspired him. They changed his life. He would have been in Bronx High School of Science. All right, I don't say he would have been a Frum Jew, I hope. But the knowledge he has today, he would not have had in Teirat Hashem Tamima. I can go even right up to Thursday night at the funeral. So, it's not easy for me to stand. At my age, I always like to sit. So, they're being maspid. So I went into a corner. There were benches for women. For the men, there were very few. But I went into a corner. I sat on the bench. And when the haspedim were over, the children spoke, and they're now ready to move the body out and go to the kfura. So a lady comes over to me and literally emotional and tears in her eyes. She says, "Are you Rabbi Rakefet?" So I apologize. I always answer. I had that problem right now and I'm giving a haskam and they want titles. I say, "I'm Aaron Rakefet. I wasn't born with titles and I won't die with titles." Okay, she says, "Well, Rebbe, you saved my life," etc. She was my student in a certain institution that was going right-wing, and many of these American girls suffered with the shtick, women must wear stockings, etc. I don't know, I don't want to be vulgar, but toenails, I don't know if there's any crime in exposing them, if you understand me. And she suffered, and she said, you really, and I've heard this from quite a few people, so if quite a few girls from that era. So you see, a teacher has tremendous influence, but you have to know how to teach. And I told my grandson, who I have one grandson who's emulating me in teaching at Shalavim, and I told him, you have to love every student, even if he's not a tzaddik. Everyone has an neshama. And you love the neshama within him, and try to inspire him. But even if you don't succeed entirely, at least you'll have some influence. And you have to know how to teach. You can't walk into class and expect students to stand up for you and revere you and not throw spitballs at you, etc. Some of you know my line that I never wrote on the board from the day I came in Aliyah. I never write, it's true. But I always say, you know why I don't write on the board? Because when I wrote on the board in the 60s, spitballs came my way with my back to the students. So Mr. Mendelovich understood this, and he was lucky. You remember I told you about Eishtat? He got Rav Simcha Wasserman to head it. Rav Simcha Wasserman, we're talking the early 40s, had just come to America, and he was Rebbe Elchanan's son, but he was different than Rebbe Elchanan. You see, this is also fascinating, the difference between the Rav and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. two totally different personalities. And people who yet knew their parents used to tell me, the Rav is like his father, Reb Moshe, and Reb Aaron is like his mother, Revitzin Pesha. And they were totally different. The Rav, you shook when you approached him in his prime. Reb Aaron, you could approach, you didn't realize what a gadol b'Torah, what knowledge. He was just a down-to-earth human mortal. When you got to know him, like Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, he claimed he was the greatest influence in his life. You all know Reb Aaron's relationship, the Reb Aaron to his wife's uncle. And it's, you can go on and on in the difference between two brothers, seemingly the same mother and father. It's the same thing, Reb Simcha, as you saw from that description, and as I heard from others, he was down to earth. He Americanized to a certain degree. He enjoyed a good laugh. He was much broader than his father, Reb Chanan. And he was fabulous for what he was needed when they opened up the Eish Dot and they began with teaching teachers how to teach. Now, Mr. Mendelovich saw this has to be organized. World War II is ending. And there's a certain realization that the future of Torah depends upon the United States. I have to tell you, and I don't have to apologize, you all know I'm a 100% religious Zionist, but Israel was not yet on the map. It's Palestine. It's struggling. There are 500,000 Jews. America has 5 million Jews, and so many refugees are pouring into America, and we can't depend upon Europe anymore. It's either we survive in America or Torah is gone. Hitler has succeeded. The time was ripe. The people were inspired. A student growing up at that time, they had that feeling, Europe is gone. It's either we make it or we break it, but it's up to us. And Mr. Mendelovich, by 1944, starts to talk in terms of an organization, a Torah Mesorah, and gets Balabatim involved, there's money involved, and Torah Mesorah is on the map. Now, and here I'm picking up on very important new material that will color our lectures for the next few weeks to come. Torah Mesorah did something else. Yes, rabbis, teachers, trained teachers, curriculum, financial support, seed money, these were all magnificent ideas. But they added one more idea, which becomes dominant, and becomes a source of controversy. It's not something you'll see from my lectures why it becomes a source of controversy. But let's go back to the founding of Agudat Yisrael. Gentlemen, Agudat Yisrael, they spoke about before World War I. They held the conference 1912. It was a meeting to call another meeting. A grand meeting was planned for 1914. Rabbi Cook left Israel to go to the meeting. Rabbi Rebel was invited from America to the meeting. He didn't go. That meeting never took place. It's not like today you get on a plane at night and you daven Shacharis in Woodmere the next morning. So it was a different world than travel. World War I broke out and that meeting was canceled. Rabbi Cook got stuck in Europe, Switzerland, then from England back chief rabbi of Jerusalem. Finally, Aguda is organized 1919. That's when it starts functioning. And Aguda made two rules that govern classic Aguda position until today. One rule was very simple. are going to declare that anyone who believed there could be Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel at that time, Palestine, before the coming of Mashiach, was nothing but a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, heinous, ruthless, depraved, degenerate, devout, surreptitious, apikoros, plain and simple. And they were not allowed to join. See, that was, from a historic point of view, it's a sad decision, because you divided up Torah Jews, a division which goes on until today. Am kishei orifu. But that was one decision, a famous decision. Do not ask me when it was revoked. No one has been able to answer that question. The Yedei Charedut has field day in the Turakata. If you read their publications time and again, they will ask Agudah, how dare you shit in the Knesset? How dare you become Sarim? How dare you take money? Apikarsim, money, who took money from Shkatsim, Merushim, everything that Rakefet called them, religious Zionist money, etc. All right, well, that question you can ask the heads of Agudat Israel, don't ask me. And I can even tell you, some of their heads will laugh with you and say, we have the same question. I know some of the Rabbi Gedoli Israel who head up Agudat. It's a different world today. The other decision they made, which is still very real, was Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. That no decision is made of any importance. All right, it could be to paint the walls white or gray. We'll leave that up to the Balabatim who run the office. But any decision of any importance that has any bearing upon religious issues, spirituality, only the Gedolei Yisrael can make that decision. And this is a crucial decision of Agudat Yisrael. Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah continues until today. You have a Moetzet in America, you have a Moetzet in Israel. In Israel, unfortunately, there's a tripod split. You have a Moetzet of Agudah, which is the Litvisha branch. It's Rabbi Shach's people. Then you have the Moetzet of the Hasidic people of Agudah. And then you have, of course, the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of Shas. So you have a triple division. 1944, in establishing the ground rules for Torah Mesorah, Mr. Mendelovich introduced this exact idea into Torah Mesorah. It's called the Rabbinical Supervisory Council, later called the Rabbinical Administrative Board, RAB. And there's no question that the RAB, the Rabbinic Administrative Board, was exactly the concept of Torah Mesorah. There were 15 rabbis appointed to the board. Any question that came up with day schools, with She'ilotin day schools, how to run them, how they'll be composed, what to do with the student body, what do you teach in the day schools, every last decision on this level that affects Torah, spirituality, religiosity, the Rabbinic Advisory Board, the Rabbinic Administrative Board, is the ultimate and sole authority. And this became part of Torah Mesorah. It continues until this very day. Now, why does this create problems? I'll tell you right away, the greatest problem that Torah Mesorah had to face, and it's an ongoing problem, what do you do in organizing a day school? 20 families are interested. 10 boys and 10 girls. They're children. You run the day school with mixed classes, you'll have a day school. You'll separate the boys and girls, The Balabatan will tell you, go fly a kite. We don't have the money to organize 2-day schools. This issue haunts us. It's an issue that has been on the Rabbinic Administrative Board of Torah Mesorah from time immemorial. Where do you find a solution? And it all depended, the community, the Balabatim, the money involved, the Rabbanim, the Gedolei Yisrael who involved. I'll tell you one story that illustrates it all. And I heard this story directly from Rabbi Simcha Krauss. And I think I've mentioned it before in the Kollel over the decades. Rabbi Simcha Krauss, who I know quite well, is a wonderful individual. He's a fabulous human being, and he's a real Talmud Chacham. And I know people who knew him when he was single yet. His father was a Rav in Washington Heights. Charlie, you probably remember Rabbi Krauss's father, right? Baruch Hashem, I'm not making it up. His father was a Rav in Washington Heights. Reb Simcha was a Talmud of Rav Hutner. He loved Rav Hutner. I know a lady told me she went out with him. She couldn't handle it. Every other word was the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Rosh Yeshiva. All right. Now, you all know Rav Simcha Krauss today in the year 2022 is more at home in Chovevei Torah than he is in Yeshiva University. And my high, how did this happen? And Reb Simcha explained to me. He became rabbi in St. Louis. He organized the first day school in St. Louis. And just a handful of parents were interested. He went to Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, went to the Rosh Yeshiva, and asked the Rosh Yeshiva, what should he do? He says, if I insist on separate classes, there will be no day school. If I begin with mixed classes, we will have a day school. Rav Hutner told him, Yehareg v'al yavo, you're not allowed to have mixed classes. Well, the rest is history. The day school was organized. It's l'kavod l'tiferet. What ultimately happens in the day schools is in the year 2022, you don't have to be a right winger to understand. Very difficult to have boys and girls together above a certain age. At one time, people, I've said this many times, and out on the coast, Rabbi Tulushkin's partner, what's the name, the guy who has the Jack, you're the radio station. He said more than once that when I went to Flatbush Yeshiva High School, I could have gone to a general high school. I would have had the same ethical moral values. I wouldn't have had Shabbat per se, but the fact that you don't have premarital relations, the fact that you don't commit adultery, all this was part of the ethic at the time. It was ingrained even in Hollywood. When Ingrid Bergman had a child out of an adulterous relationship, they wouldn't let her star in any film. Do you remember that? These are facts. But today, God have mercy, what the world has become. And this is a real problem that is recognized not just by right-wingers. It's recognized by everyone, I would say, 99% of frum Jews, and even those who aren't frum, but have values. I know one case was right in this building. There was a secretary here who came, a very wonderful lady, but not frum, and her daughter brought home a boy, and they want to sleep in one room, and they're not married, far from married, high school kids. And her husband was hysterical, wouldn't let his daughter and this boy into the house, not under his roof. I said to her, I don't understand your husband. You raised the kids without religion, without Shabbat, without Kashrut. Their only values today are the Western world, as portrayed in Maariv, in Yediyot Achronot, in Haaretz. They have no other values. You raise them. How can you stop them? Boys and girls, they're consenting. They're over 16. What's the problem? They're giving out the prophylactics in the high school. God have mercy what we're where we're at. So ultimately, this issue hung fire. Generally speaking, what they work out is at the end of three grades, preferably, they separate if they can't. At the end of six grades already, by seventh grade, be separate. And there are many day schools where someone's holding up the sign of the name. Dennis Prager, thank you. The name I wanted was Dennis Prager. That's the friend of Rabbi Tolushkin. Dennis Prager went to Flatbush at Gedapsein Mefrum, considering his outlook and his background and his education, he should be a total Shomer Torah mitzvah. But all right, he's a big conservative with a small C, and at times he has thoughts that I dance to. And what I just said is very profound and very correct. And this issue haunted the Rabbanim. I'll tell you what else is interesting. If you look at the volume I'm quoting from, The Day Schools and Torah Mesorah by Doniel Tzvi Kramer, look on page 15. He gives you the names of the advisory board as it began. And you'll notice that back in 1944, 1945, some of the members were Rosh Yeshiva, and some of the members were practicing rabbis. You had them, Litvisha Talmidei Chachamim, out in the rabbinate. Over the years, it shifted almost entirely to Rosh Yeshiva. I'll read some of the names. Rabbi Chaim Isaac Bloch, that was a practicing rabbi. Israel Dushowitz was a practicing rav in Brooklyn. My Talmud, Rabbi Feinberg, said to me, he's publishing, he works in publishing, he's publishing Chidushei Torah from Rabbi Dushowitz. Reb Moshe Feinstein, Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Reuven Grzebski, Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Chaim Shlomo Hyman, Rosh Yeshiva, Teira Vidas. Reb Yitzchak Kutner, Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Avram Yaffen, Rosh Yeshiva Nevadik. Reb Avram Kamenovich, Rosh Yeshiva Mir. Reb Aaron Kutler, Lakewood. Eliyahu Kushelevsky, he was a Rosh Yeshiva, ultimately he winds up in Israel, the Kushelevsky family. Reb Asher Nissen Levitan, that already was a Rav of the Shul, a different gestalt. Reb Moshe Rosen, a Gadol Shebegadolim, was a Rav of the Shul in Brooklyn. Reb Yaakov Ruderman, Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Mordechai Shulman was living in America then, Slabodka Rosh Yeshiva. Reb Moshe Binyamin Tabishov, that was the Mabit from Brooklyn. He was a Rav of the Shul. That's Jerry Blitzstein's grandfather. My classmate, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. From that picture of that I identified everyone, I plead it should be published and republished while there's still a few alive to benefit that they live on. They've been identified. Reb Mendel Zaks, Rosh Yeshiva, and you can understand that this board of rabbis becomes very, very important, but it creates an image of Agudat Yisrael. Now, it creates the image of Agudat Yisrael, and that takes us into the whole question of Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. I can tell you one of the great shocks, when I came in Aliyah, I had a lot of problems figuring out where I belong. It's not like today, where I belong in Aaron Rakefitz, behind Aaron Rakefitz's desk. This is where I belong. But in those days, I went to Mekas Harav, I went to Hebron, I tried to see, I didn't grow up here, try to understand what was happening. So I met a Talmud who yet studied in Kelm. Reb Elchanan Blumenthal, a Talmud who yet studied with Reb Daniel in Kelm before World War II. And he wound up exiled. He was German originally, went to Lithuania, wound up in Britain. Britain expelled to Australia in camp because he may be an enemy, a Jew born in Germany. You remember what went on. And I came to Israel here, and he was in Chinuch here, established here, Rabbi Doctor Elchanan Blumenthal. I later taught his daughter, and I remember he said to me, You know, and I didn't, I came here, I was not as big a religious Zionist as I am today. I had an understanding of Agudah as well. And I said to him, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, I said it with awe, with feeling. And he looked at me, what are you talking about? It's not a Moetzet, they're not Gedolim, and they have no Torah. And you understand, and I need not tell you, this is a valid argument that goes on until today, as someone who saw with his own eyes, the Gerach Siddim and Rav Shach. Believe me, I'm inclined to doubt or to be somewhere in the middle about the godlet of Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. But there's no question that this governing board became the most powerful element in Torah Mesorah, and it certainly created an image, considering the names I just mentioned. The overwhelming majority of these great Rabbanim were identified with Agudat Yisrael and not the Mizrahi. Now, this is briefly an understanding of how Torah Mesorah began. I'll go into more details in a moment. I want to deal with personalities. But if you want a complete history and a very lovely coffee table book, I don't know whether Torah Vidas got the idea from Torah Mesorah, Torah Mesorah got the idea from Torah Vidas. There's a volume that came out. Again, I cannot lift both books together. To lift one at a time, I have to say a prayer, the Rebbein Shem should give me strength. The volume is called Planting Chinuch Across America. The Torah Umesorah Story, City by City. Again, I repeat, Planting Chinuch Across America, the Torah Mesorah Story, City by City, published in Brooklyn by Torah Mesorah, 2019. Now, I'll tell you what makes that volume so fascinating. When you speak about the Yeshiva University, you're speaking about one institution in Washington Heights. All right, that has branches in Manhattan, in the Bronx, the medical school, Stern College, Cardoza Law School. You talk about Torah Vidas, you're speaking about an institution in Brooklyn, all right, that has an elementary school, a high school, a Matifta. You're talking about one institution in Brooklyn. You speak about Lakewood, you're talking about Lakewood, New Jersey, one major institution. Of course, their graduates have established various types of yeshiva and outreach across the world, actually, not just the United States. But when you speak of Torah Mesorah, you're speaking of an institution that's centralized, and you're speaking of 10, 100, 200, 500 branches across the United States and somewhat Canada as well. You follow? You're talking about all these different day schools. And what's fascinating about this book, City by City, the truth of the matter is that no two schools are alike. The end results of Torah Mesorah have to be a reflection of the local population. So across the board from 44 until today, there were various compromises, various configurations. You cannot say every school is exactly the same. You'll take Torah Vidas, all right, in Brooklyn today, what can I tell you? BTA closed down, Central closed down, a modern Orthodox voice, and I'm using popular language because I hate the word modern Orthodoxy, but I can't escape it. I would use the word Western Orthodoxy. A Western Orthodox voice, few and far between. But that's Brooklyn. You go out to Minneapolis, you go out to St. Louis, you go out to Detroit, you go out to Toronto, you go out to Brooklyn, Brookline, Massachusetts, Sharon, Massachusetts, Philadelphia, wherever you go, you can have beautiful day schools, but there's no question the hashkafa, the outlook, the ultimate goal will not be totally like Teira V'Das in Brooklyn. And Torah Mesorah has been big enough and smart enough. At times, there has been controversy, but they understand very well you can have boys and girls totally separate in Brooklyn, but it could very well be in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the first grades have to be mixed. You have to start that way. And of course, that takes us back to the question that I have suffered with for many decades. It comes up in the documentary I brought into the world, Maimonides. Maimonides began boys and girls together, a handful. And the question everyone is raised, did the Rav believe in coeducation? Was it an ideal? And I don't know, I don't want to give a black and white answer. The Rav established Maimonides in the mid-30s, there's no question, had it not been mixed, there would have been no Maimonides. Then you have to ask yourself, later in life, Maimonides expands. You can divide it, you can separate. All right. Not so simple. Once an institution begins, it begins with a certain outlook, a certain Weltanschauung. It has its own momentum. It's like people ask today, why don't the Reform and Conservative merge? Logically speaking, what is the difference between JTS today and Hebrew Union College? They're both mechallel the halacha, change the halacha, laugh at the halacha, alter the halacha, innovate the halacha. For both of them, the concept of halacha as a binding, authoritative concept of naseh v'nishma does not exist. So why do you waste so much money on two separate institutions? It's a valid question today. 70 years ago, it was not a valid question. But today it is. But the answer is very simple. You have faculty, administration, you have money, you have trustees. It carries its own weight. It's like someone running. You don't stop in the middle of running. You're in a race. No, you're running. You don't stop. It continues. So that's one part of the answer. But another part of the answer is the Rav sincerely felt that if women would be separated from men, they would get an inferior education. You have to understand that the attitude then, that it was women. Why do they need such a chinuch like a man? The first yeshivot in America were for boys. No one dreamt of having yeshivot for girls. My mother-in-law, who was a tzaddikid, she went to public school. What? There were no yeshivot then for her. There was Chaim Berlin already in Brooklyn, but that was for boys. That was for boys. That was the attitude. A girl? Malka, my wife, went to Ramaz, and at a certain age, the boys had Talmud, and she had home economics. And my wife was furious. I mean, I met my wife yet. She was a younger. She, wife, the boys are studying Gemara. Why can't I? But even in Ramaz, they had the attitude, the girl has home economics. I mean, I'm living today in the year 2022. My grandsons all know how to cook. I can't get over it. There just was in Givat Shmuel. I had two grandsons, one married, one with his girlfriend. They ate together Friday night. And one grandson, he made the chicken. He made the chicken. And we were talking about this in the House of Mourning Saturday night, how Sam, you know, what he did for food after his wife. His wife was a fabulous balabusta. What did he do? He didn't know how to cook. So he went from the freezer to the microwave. I said his daughter would put food in the freezer, and he would put it in the microwave. I said, that's exactly my ability. I am the greatest chef in the world, taking from the freezer to the microwave. But today, it's amazing, home economics. The boys are equal to the girls. I look, it's the world. I'm not saying it's halakhically forbidden, but I understand that the world has changed. But the rub, it could very well be. Now, today there's another problem. In the rub's time, you could run a school with boys and girls together through high school, through they were ready to go to college. Today there's another problem. I don't want to spell it out, but I'm well aware, unfortunately, that some modern Orthodox high schools have had problems. I don't want to spell it out. Leave it at that. I can tell you in my time, even from Torah Vedasa already, you had stories of people having to live, man and woman had to leave New York for 2 years and come back married 2 years later with a child or two. I don't know, again, my mouth doesn't like to talk about these things. But this is a real problem today. So I said it to a real someone I don't identify, but someone in the Rav's, as close as you can be to the Rav. And she said to me, you're right, that today I don't know if my father would be in favor of a mixed high school. And I remember, this I can tell you, B'didi HaViyuvda, I remember when High Life began, Hebrew Institute, Long Island, it's gone through mergers, what is it today, Haftar, am I correct? Brian, shake your head if I'm right. High Life is part of Haftar today? You don't, it's part. Okay, Brian, Rabbi Klo agrees, I'm in good ground. So when High Life began, it was big news there. You don't start to appreciate that in Far Rockaway, there's going to be a yeshiva high school. Jews are living in Far Rockaway who care about Torah. And they can't, Rabbi Lyman, Harold Lyman, it's the father of Professor Lyman, Shnur Lyman, came to the Rav, a whole committee at yeshiva in Dr. Belkin's conference room, and we kids stood outside the room with our ears on the door to hear what was going on. And they asked the Rav about running classes together. And I, as I recall, we were told that the Rav said, don't use Maimonides as an example. I had no choice. It was either beginning with 5 students, mixed, or having no day school at all. You can't run a day school 2 for a girl and 3 boys, 2 separate. So it's a very fascinating question. Halacha l'maisa, if you ask Aaron Rakefet, I'm 1,000,000,000% running 2 separate schools. However, if you have no choice, I can understand very well, begin. And at a later stage, we will separate classes. You follow me, Meisha? It's the reality of the community, of the situation. And Torah Mesorah had to constantly deal with this problem. And ultimately, there were people of the Rabbanim who were more, people of the Moetzet, I would call it, who were more right-wing. Others saw it a little bit differently. Ultimately, 90% of the cases they were able to work out. But this image of the Rabbinical Advisory Board remains very important on an operative level and also creating a certain image of Torah Umesorah, which was good and yet evoked opposition, as we will see. Now, I continue with Daniel Kramer's doctorate, Rabbi Dr. Daniel Kramer, a very fine individual. I yet knew his father and his mother, very fine family. His father, professor of law at U of P and rabbi of a prominent congregation in Philadelphia proper. These were interesting people. Philadelphia was a difficult city as far as Torah was concerned 70, 80 years ago. And these were people who, to a certain degree, went against the trend there. Now, when you talk of Torah Mesorah, you talk, of course, of Mr. Mendelovich, but you also talk of Reb Aaron Kotler. And here I want to pay homage to Reb Aaron and spell out a little bit about this period. Mr. Mendelovich dies in 48. Reb Aaron arrived in America in 41. How did Reb Aaron get to America? What was the story? And I've told it many times over the last 62 years of teaching Torah. The Var Hatzalah, which I write about, and I was the first one to really publish on Bar Hatzalah, and Rabbi Zurov stood on my shoulder, and he had the Bar Hatzalah archives were open by the time he did his doctorate at Hebrew U. So whenever you ask about Bar Hatzalah, you have to do Rakefet Suva era first, and then Zurov's doctorate published. It's in English. He did his doctorate in English. It's a very important volume. And Torah Mesorah was able to get the State Department to agree to bring over one great rabbi. There, an opening, one great rabbi. How many people could have been saved by America? It's tragic, but we can't redo history. Can't undo and redo. So in Europe and in America, they debated who to bring. And they decided to bring Rav Aaron Cutler. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler was about 48 years old. He was born in 1892, make the Tishuv in 1940. How old was he? 48. Rav Aaron was not that famous. He was an Ilui. Everyone knew him as the Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva. But there were other Rosh Yeshiva who were more famous in their 60s, 70s. But the choice fell on Rav Aaron because of a very simple fact of life. When I was in my 40s, I was teaching maybe 32, 34 hours a week in various schools. You have energy. You grow older, your energy is much more limited. You have to work within the confines of the reality of your physical abilities. The chishuv was that Rav Aaron, being in his 40s, was a dynamo. And he would do more to save more Jews than anyone else could have. And they brought him to America. And Rav Aaron comes to San Francisco, travels by coach all the way to New York. And he sets the tone. I describe it in the Suvira, the Cavalera Synagogue, the East Side. I know people who were there. I knew people who were there. And he gives, here in America, which kid didn't want to go to college? And he gets up and says, if we're all going to go to college, there'll be no Torah left. There's no Torah left in Europe. Everything is being destroyed. Everything depends upon what we do here. We have to raise B'nai Torah, we have to be dedicated. And from that group that heard him speak, that's how Lakewood is organized. I'm being very quick now. The truth of the matter is, there was in White Plains already with Rav Mendel Zaks. They had organized a Ke'ena Kolel of learning on a very high level. But it didn't take off. Rav Mendel, it didn't take off. But Rav Aaron decided, goes to Lakewood, away from the hustle bustle of New York, begins with 13 students essentially, and go and dream what would become of Lakewood. Now, before he got involved with Lakewood, the first year and a half that he was in America, the first 2 years, totally involved in Vat Hatzalah. Reb Lazer Silver established it, but Reb Aaron put it on the map. And Reb Aaron, when he gave a bang, you jumped. And I know people describe to me what went on in the Vat Hatzalah. I had a student, he's no longer alive, Jesse Klausen. His mother was the secretary there. She got married late. She devoted her life. She was a terrific secretary because she was fluent in Hebrew, English, and Yiddish. Her brother was the famous Rabbi Stefanski, who wrote on Minhag Eretz Yisrael, etc. And Reb Aaron. But by 43, there was no one left to save. You couldn't get anyone out of Europe. The doors were closed. So that's how he shifted, although he still was active in Bar Hatzalah, and after World War II, with the DP camps. Well, it's 44 Torah Mesorahs organized. Reb Aaron threw himself totally into Torah Mesorah. He was the chairman of the Rabbinical Administrative Board, the RAB. Rabbanan was criticized. How do you get so involved with Torah Mesorah? You have to raise funds for Torah Mesorah. What about Lakewood? This is a quote from Rabbanan. Let my yeshiva suffer, so long as thereby Jewish children will at least know the alphabet. And this was Rabbanan. This, he went way beyond it to see this responsibility, the Klal Yisrael. You're not narrow-minded. When people criticized the Rav, he helped raise funds for Chinuch Atzmai. He once gave a $100 check to Scheinberg of the Eidah Haredit. And then they said, well, but I'm living it in Yiddish, but I'll say it in English. What, he's not a Shema Shabbos? But Rebbe, they'll demonstrate against you when you come to Israel. So the Rav had a sense of humor and said, but he promised me he won't use my money to put up placards against me. All right. But this is Klal Yisrael, responsibility. And this is Rebbe Aaron. As Torah Umesorah expanded, they needed an administrative staff that could meet the demands. The first full-time professional to work for Torah Mesorah was Dr. Samuel Raphael Weiss. He later leaves, he heads up the OU. Do you recognize the name? He's named for Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. Samson Raphael Weiss tells you right away, German origins, good organization. He put Torah Mesorah on the map. The problem of mixed classes haunts the institution right from the start. It's the greatest problem the Rabbanim have to deal with. Many times, Rabbi Dr. Weiss was criticized. He's too lenient. The people working in Torah Mesorah, essentially all Torah Vadas graduates, Rabbi, we mentioned names last time, Rabbi Gross, Rabbi Goldenberg, criticized, but always they tried to find a compromise. If we can't separate now, we'll separate in a few years. We'll announce after the third grade, it'll be separated. After the sixth grade, it'll be separated. The institution is functioning. People are totally committed. You take Rabbi Alexander Gross, Torah Vadas graduate, Talmud Mufakov, Mr. Mendelovich, and he works around the clock until he winds up principal of the day school in South Florida, where he has to sever his relationship with the New York office on a daily basis. But you don't find people like this anywhere else. They ability, capability, vision, school, curriculum, hiring teachers, reaching out to students. That's his daughter, Aurelie Cantor, Aurelie Gross. She's a principal in Boca Raton today. And people say she is fabulous. People write about her. She's a legendary figure. And I can tell you, when a guy named Rakefet had her as a student, Michala, Rakefet was fear. What kind of name is this, Aurelie? Gaiva, Choshechli. But if you do a little good in class, you become Aura. And if you're fabulous, then you're Aurelie. But not at the start of class. At the end of class. Oh, she never forgot that. Kanayin Hara. What a personality. What a teacher. That's Rabbi Alexander Gross's daughter. There was Rabbi Bernard Goldenberg. Also, it's all part of the same crowd. This man was so dedicated to Torah Mesorah that he lived in Bayit Vagan. I knew him, Besofia Mav. Many people from Torah Mesorah wound up in Bayit Vagan at the end. And Besofia Mav, do you know that during his Sheva Brachas, he worked on the first issue of Olamenu? Do you know what Olamenu was? It was the Torah Mesorah publication for kids in the day school. and my wife, they announced the contest for drawing kids. They attract kids in day schools. My wife won a prize for one of the pictures she drew in Olamenu. And during his Sheva Brachas, that's what he worked on. Now, while all this is happening, there's another problem, the problem which modern life has ameliorated to a certain degree. And I'll tell you what the problem was. The people in the office could work out in the field, could make decisions. The minute it reached a higher level of decision, something that affects Torah civilization, Weltanschauung, you had to have the rabbinic advisory board or the rabbinic administrative board make the decision. How can they get to the office? They're all busy. Reb Aaron Cutler is in Lakewood. Reb Aaron later, after he dies, succeeded Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. How do they get there all the time? How do you have later Rabbi Ruderman, who lives in Baltimore? He's not exactly going to leave Baltimore weekly. How do you have a president of RCA today who lives out on the coast? So you see, over the years, this problem ameliorated itself. We have instant communication. You fellas grew up with instant communication. You can't appreciate what it's all about. I can tell you just a little story where you'll see it before your eyes. Yom HaShoah, we're walking out of, walking in Katamon, what's the hospital called? It's not a hospital, they do. Miskavledach. We start to say Mayanea Yeshua. You get confused with all the names. But Miskavledach was in the old city originally, then it came out. It used to be, late, it became Hartman's there, then they went to build this big building, or they built it, I believe. And we're working out of Mane, at Miskavledach, and we meet this couple on the street. It's right after the siren. And we see let me tell the story. It's worth knowing what goes on in this world. We see this couple talking to two typical Israeli young college students, perhaps after army, two boys with big dogs. And then we realize the couple open up Washington. You'll see that Rakefet writes about a non-Jewish family from Holland, the Rodius family, Johan and Krista, Krista and Johan. These people were so helpful to the Baumels. Anytime a Secretary of State was here, they had a place in there in Jerusalem Post about the three boys missing in action. The Rodiuses raised the money for it in Holland. There was a demonstration in Washington. They brought part of a tank to Washington, put it outside the Capitol building. The Rodiuses arranged the payment for everything, people to go to Washington, demonstrate. It turns out that Krista's grandfather was Jewish. So they have the right, Kol Kashvut, to live in Israel. So they live here. They live here in the heart of Israel, in the building next to the shul, next to the hospital, Miskavledach. And we meet them on the street, and I say to Malka, I bet they're giving Musa to these kids. Do you appreciate Israel? These are non-Jews, but exactly right. They were giving Musa to these two kids without kippot, with dogs. Yom HaShoah, do you realize what Yom HaShoah is? You know, in Holland, 80%, 70%+ of the Jews were killed. Of course, they had records in City Hall, who's Jewish, who's not Jewish. They were very organized in Holland, like Germans. The Germans came in, it's beyond words what went on. Beyond words what Hitler did to us and what we, and we had no power to yell, to shout. So a lot to talk here, a lot to learn, a lot to write about, which I'm doing my share, Be'ezrat Hashem. Okay, so I tell the Rodiuses, oh, we're happy to see them. I tell them I write about you in Washington. They didn't know about the book. So you know what? I'm going to Xerox the pages and send them to you. So I call my daughter, And I asked my daughter, can you give me the Rhodius's address? She says, what do you want their address? I said, I wanted to, you're going to send them in the mail? I'll give you their email. I left on Sherry's desk this morning 3 pages with a handwritten letter on top, send to the Rhodius's email. You follow? You don't realize. Instant communication. My daughter is right. I'm going to drop a letter in the post office. Ribbono shel Olam, it'll take 3.5 weeks to get there. Sphere will be over. Who knows what, when, where? Instant communication. It is. You don't raise the world. This was a real problem. And this, if you'll ask the insiders who worked in the offices of Torah Mesorah, this was their biggest problem. At times, they couldn't make a decision. They'd call a meeting. The Gedolim, or the majority, 15, 8 would show up, 9, 2 weeks later. You follow? You couldn't do it overnight. People had to plan. And this problem, again, it's the relationship, the RAB, and the administrative board. Now, when Reb Aaron died in 1962, Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky was elected to the head of the Rabbinic Advisory Committee. Under Reb Yaakov, it was a lot better, because Reb Yaakov lived in Brooklyn. So to go from Brooklyn to Manhattan was not the end of the world. Later on, when Reb Yaakov moves out to Muncie, Spring Valley, Muncie, to that area, so of course, he's older and he's not going to jump back and forth. He retires, and his cousin, Reb Yaakov Ruderman, becomes the head. And Reb Yaakov Ruderman, and Reb Moshe was the assistant. Reb Moshe, at this level of chinuch, Reb Moshe was not that active. He already had Tiferet Yerushalayim, and it said, and being Reb Moshe and the responsor, his writings, his answering, Reb Moshe already had his plate more than full. But Reb Yaakov, and Reb Yaakov personality-wise, there was a certain worldliness to Reb Yaakov. Those of you who have heard about Reb Yaakov, I know many of you, some of you met Reb Yaakov, there was a worldliness to him. In other words, when people came out in Muncie against the Gachveis, people riding bikes, and Reb Yaakov said, what's wrong with it? He says, Halvai, I would know how to ride a bike. There was a certain worldliness to him. So he was a fabulous person to head Torah Mesorah and handle all these different questions, as we will see when we come into the one name I have not mentioned, that is the most famous name of Torah Mesorah's history, and we'll come to that. That is, of course, the person who put it on the map, guided it, and that, of course, is the second Kamenetsky, not Reb Yaakov, but it seems a distant cousin. We'll talk about him in detail. Not only a distant cousin, but I mean, what makes it all the more fascinating is he was a YU person, but we'll come to it. I want to give you the background, and then we're going to zero in on Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky, who we've spoken about before in terms of Rabbi Leo Young. But I want to come back. When Rabbi Ruderman took over, well, then there really was a critique that how often does he get to New York? So he appointed two of his, I would say, one of them was a Talmud, later his son-in-law, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, who later becomes the Rosh Yeshiva of Nei Yisrael, and Reb Elia Tzve, who you all know of Philadelphia. He asked them to go into New York regularly to represent him, to answer the questions, and to guide the balabatim, the workers, the decisions that have to be made. Two families come to the fore who become, without them, Torah Mesorah would not have survived. They poured in their own money. They raised a fortune of money. And here you come to the Feuerstein family of Brookline and the Bunim family of Brooklyn. What I've told you more than once, in Brookline you have Sam Feuerstein, and Sam Feuerstein, I believe it's Hungarian origins. This is a balabas, total commitment to Torah. Malden Mills, very successful manufacturing fabric. His son, Moshe Feuerstein, Sam and Mo, what a combination. Mo, no one was president for more years of the OU than Mo Feuerstein. And you had here a certain broadness that could relate from Reb Aaron Cutler through the entire gamut of great Rabbanim in America. I would say that the Feuersteins revered the Rav and Reb Aaron Cutler. You have another family also, interestingly, in the fabric business in New York, Irwin and Amos Bunim. Irwin, balabas par excellence, total commitment. One of the founders of the Young Israel movement. His son Amos, a YU graduate. I knew him quite well. Go back to Sam and Mo. Mo, a YU graduate. And these were two families, all business people, but total commitment, the money, the effort, the fundraising, the publicity, second to none. And I want to mention another name. The Bunims and the Feuersteins are well known. Any history of Torah in America, you must write about them. I want to mention another very fascinating name. The earliest professional fundraiser who developed their fundraising office, called Directive Development, their fundraising ability, with someone that you all know from a different stance, Rabbi Bernard Levy. Rabbi Bernard Levy, who, Chassid of Chabad, very devoted to the seventh Rebbe. His first prominent position was with Torah Mesorah. Rabbi Beryl Levy had an ability as a Klal Yisrael mensch. He knew how to talk to everyone and anyone, Jew, Gentile. And he was the first director of development for Torah Mesorah. How do you know him? Half the food you eat is under his hashgacha. He's the Beryl Levy who established the OK. The OK, which people call it popularly a Chabad Hashkacha. Well, it's not formally a Chabad Hashkacha, but Rebbe Levy and his son, Reb Yisachar, I believe the name, who died Corona this past year, two terrific Chabad Hasidim, 100%. And the Chof K, one of the big three, the OU, the Chaf K and the OK. The OK began, we spoke about it, began in opposition to the OU. It was a chemist who began it, and he refused, if I recall correctly, the name is Goldberg. I spoke about it in class, I had my notes in front of me, and he refused, he felt Hashkacha should be free of charge. And he opposed the OU. He felt you can go in and inspect the ingredients like the English system and then say if it's kosher or not, but there should be no charge, all right? Obviously, that cannot work out on a practical level because they give hashgacha, you need mashgichim, you need rabbanim, you need supervision, you need people there. You have to run a tremendous computer program today. The OU runs with the big three and the Eidah Haredit hashgacha. They run a computer program where you have every ingredient. I saw it in the other day, showed it to me. Every ingredient in the world, where it's made, what it is, can there possibly be a chash, where there's kosher, where there's not kosher, and it's beyond words. So anyway, the original, okay, later was bought by Rebbe Levi, and he turned it into a major Hashgacha organization. But what's fascinating with Rebbe Levi, that he originally got started with klal work, not just as a Lubavitcher Chassid, but working in Torah Mesorah, responsible for fundraising. And let me just end off with two other little episodes. Bring it to home. At a certain point, Torah Mesorah would have a yearly banquet, a big fundraiser, and one year they decided to honor Samuel Feuerstein, the father of Mo Feuerstein. We just spoke about him. And they had a Sefer Torah written to be presented to him. Torah written in his honor, written Lishmo, Lishma. And who do you think presented the Torah to Sam Feuerstein? Mo Yurebi, Yosef Dov, Harav Yosef Dov, Halevi Soloveitchik. A very moving moment. And then there was Siegfried Bentheim. I hope you've heard of the name of the Bentheim family. This is the founder, Siegfried Bentheim. And when he died, Torah Mesorah established an ongoing annual award to present it at the dinner to Balabatim, who followed in the path of Siegfried Bentheim. And Siegfried Bentheim, total devotion to Torah and Torah institutions. Terrific tzaddik, endless tzedaka. What a family he was privileged to bring into the world. His son Charlie, who was a bit of a chassid of mine, davened at my minyan at the Kotel, asked me his shilas. You don't know what type of people. You don't see people like this. I'll end off with the story that I've told many times, and it's worth telling again and repeated and repeated. Charlie told me in the late 30s, his father gets a check from Germany. I think it was $25,000. Maybe I'm underestimating. And it says, in payment of. And Siegfried calls over Charlie. Charlie was younger than you, was a teenager. And he says to Charlie, Charlie, this is very suspicious. This man doesn't owe me money. Go to the bank and tell our person in the bank that we deal with to open up a separate account and to keep this money separate. Charlie told me he went to the bank with the check. He said, I was shaking. I never held so much money in my hand. This is like someone giving you, going to the bank today with a check for $500,000, okay? $1 million. Charlie says, all right, the guy opened it. They forgot about it. They let it roll. Let it stand. We don't need the money. In 1946, the secretary comes into Siegfried's office, and the secretary tells him, a man is here to see you, a refugee. And Siegfried says, send him in. And the man speaks German to him and says, did you get a check for $25,000 at that time? And Charlie's father says, yes, we opened a separate account for it. And the man starts crying. And he tells Charlie the story. An Orthodox Jew, Hitler still allowed the Jews to pay out money they owed outside Germany. They want them to say that the Germans don't pay their bills. So this man saw what was happening. He did research, and he found three Orthodox business people. He sent each one a check for $25,000 with a phony invoice. He survived. He said to Charlie and Siegfried, you're the, I know the family, I taught members of the family, it's very emotional for me. I know them very well. He said to Charlie, you're the only one who acknowledged receiving it. So Charlie not only gave him the money, which had grown now with interest, helped him get started in business again. And they wouldn't do the name. They said they don't want to say the name of it. They become very prosperous again. But that's the Bentheim family. And that's the award that was given in his memory every year. It's a fascinating story. We have a lot more to do. We have to pick up what I alluded to, the opposition, Aguda Mizrahi. You'll see how what went on in America. You'll see how Torah Mesorah went out. And then I have to come to the most fascinating story of all. The most famous name, because Mr. Mendelovich established Torah Mesorah, he died 4 years later. No one has done more, and his name means more. You talk of Torah Mesorah, you talk of Joe Kamenetsky. We will get there, Be'ezrat Hashem. Yomo, I have to thank you from the bottom of my heart. How did you achieve this that I wasn't cut off today and turned into a half-wit moron? You are a genius. I don't accept that because God is the ultimate, but we have to do the Hishtadlut. How many times have I told you that in the last 15 years? And it's still... All right, then we'll accept it. Then we'll accept. Moshe, do me a favor. Take him to Vilna to meet Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. I have a time machine in my office. You sit down, you type in the year and the place. 1840, Vilna, Rabbi Israel Salanter. You press a button, the machine shakes, and there you are in Vilna, Reb Yisrael, 1840. And take him by the ear and tell Reb Yisrael that this guy only speaks of bitachon and not of hishtadlut. You know what Reb Yisrael will do? Smack his face and give him a whole shear in hishtadlut and fitting it in with bitachon. What can I do? Thank you very much, Shomer. You're terrific. Charlie, see that Morty knows that today we succeeded. Once again, I apologize to all my students. I have no control over the internet and over what goes on and the Zoom. Yesterday was a nightmare for me, but at least they worked on the shiur when they put it up that it's... without the cancellations. I want to, what did we do today? So Baruch Hashem, we covered the heart of Torah Mesorah, how it develops, the Rabbinic Advisory Board, which is very, very important, as you will see. The problem of mixed classes, which is a problem that hangs fire. It's, in Brooklyn you can get away with it, but out in Kalamazoo, you have 10 families interested. Read the Torah Mesorah book, and you'll see about the families interested in each community. It's a very fascinating book. And you'll see how Torah Mesorah has to be able to reach out to communities where you're not going to find one Jew who believes in Agudat Yisrael. Every Jew is either a Mizrahiite or some secular Jew who realizes his kids will assimilate. If he doesn't, why don't I see my face? Okay, whose kids will assimilate if he doesn't give them some sort of day school education. And this is the way it began. We have a world to do because you can't talk about Torah Mesorah without reaching Joe Kamenetsky. And that will be a fascinating topic unto itself. Next Sunday, Be'ezrat HaNatan L'Yav Koach, I pick up just where I left off. And we come back to Rabbah killing Rab Zera, I don't know of any other Gemara that's so difficult to understand, because the Gemara is quite clear the halacha is not to get drunk on Purim, and yet the Shulchan Aruch says, Chayav Inishlip Sumein, the words of the Gemara, is it Rabba, is it Rava, we'll see next week. And now we come into another interesting fallout when you have Sheva Brachas on Purim, and really fascinating tshuva of Reb Menashe Klein. Jack Levinstein asks, did Reb Menashe Klein have a sense of humor? Does the Havin, when he says, understand it well, does that mean see beneath the surface? This is Purim Torah. We had quite a day yesterday, despite the Zoom, but that's a fascinating piece that no one else in the earth have a sense of humor. Rabbi Zeira dressed up as Amalek. All right, we'll see a little bit more next week. You'll see, I have a Gemara I have to show you, and it fits right in with Reb Menashe Klein. All right, are there any questions here in the classroom? Yes, Benjamin.
We mentioned that Rav Putner, and when they asked him about...
the day school.
Yeah, coeducational classes, and he said he was against it.
Totally.
But then, did he allow certain communities like post-third grade, or he said no?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I'm pretty sure there were certain times where the Rabbinic Advisory Board did allow, but he may have been a minority opinion. You got to understand, Rav Putner... I spent the whole year in Rav Putner. I'm not ashamed of my lectures on Rav Putner. What's interesting is when I spent 2 years under Lubavitcher Rebbe, I got endless comments from Lubavitcher all over the world. Ah, were they excited and interested, and if I asked a question, they answered. And Rav Putner, from his Talmidim, I didn't get one comment, one email. And the enemies of the Putner people say, they have a certain gaiva. You understand that they're not going to, you know, the whole machlok is with the Belzer Rebbe. I was just there. The funeral was from that area. And you see what Belzer's built. It's beyond words. And Rav Hutner should have been right there. I never got one comment. I quoted from the internet and rebuke what's being printed in the internet. No one comment. So I don't know. But I can only tell you with what Rav Krauss told me, and he told me that I'm repeating it word by word. If I recall correctly, Rav Krauss even used the words, Yaharig Val Yavar, you followed? That's what Rav Putner told him. And he broke with his Rebbe. That's not easy. He became very close to the Rav, to the Rav's Talmidim, and he became a great follower of a classmate of his, a colleague of his in Klein Berlin, where they both went. You know who that was? Right here in this kollel, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. Reb Aaron, from the time Rav Krauss came in Aliyah, Reb Aaron didn't give a shin the kollel that Rabbi Krauss didn't attend. Do you follow? He moved very, very close. His wife, I think, moved even a little bit more. She organized the day school and she came from a Hasidic family. At my student, Binny Krauss, their son was my dear student, Nicole. At his wedding, I'm told that all her brothers were there with Strymos. And Esther Krauss already moved much closer to Chovev Torah. All right, look, there's freedom of choice, and that's the way God made the world. And I have nothing against Chovev Torah, except when they go against tradition, when a graduate rejoices that the Supreme Court recognizes same-sex marriages and makes a shechiyonu, I'm not a happy person, you understand? I can understand there's a difference of opinion. You know that take Chabad and take Rav Shach's people in the 80s, what I saw with my own eyes, what I heard with my own ears, I was shaking. But all right, there's freedom of choice. I said that yesterday in class. I'm a Litvak. I can't change. But I recognize the new generation, which is two generations beyond me at least, to be a Litvak, to boast that at the age of 16, 15, you studied with Rav Noach Bornstein, the Talmud Mufak of the Briska Rav, Rav Velvela. Today, I don't know if Reb Noach could speak to these kids. You understand? I could tolerate him. I could understand. Tolerate? I mean, he was cynical, and you know. But I took the greatness out of him. That yes, that yes. Baruch Shekivanti, I'm the one who said he was the Brisker Rav's greatest Talmud. The biography of the Brisker Rav, I showed it in the Kol. Biography of the Brisker Rav comes out. American Rabbanim, among them Rabbi, I can tell you it was Rabbi Siegel, others, they went to visit the Brisker Rav, and the Brisker Rav says to them, I don't understand your America. My best Talmud, my top Talmud goes to America and is verschwunden geworden. He gets lost there. No one heard of him. You know who he's talking about? Rav Noach Bornstein. So Rakefet wasn't wrong when he said he was the Brisker Rav's tough Talmud. All right, that's it's a good question. And if we could ask Rabbi Krauss, we might get a better answer. He's in Riverdale now. He's involved with that Beit Din, with the Agunot, etc., which also functions out of the Chovevei crowd, not out of the YU crowd. But I don't want to say a word because I've never seen the Tshuvit. If I see the Tshuvit, I can give you an honest opinion. I'm not an Amoritz in this topic. I've published hundreds and hundreds of pages. Baruch Hashem. All right. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. Yomo, can you open up the world if there are any questions? Yomo will unmute whatever he has to do.
The recording has stopped.
Can you hear me? Are there any questions from around the world? David, Rabbi Twesky, I thank you for... Are they unmuted? No, they don't hear. We can't win. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we hear.
You hear. Rabbi Twesky, I thank you for what you sent me. I'll talk about it on next Sunday, Be'ezrat Hashem. Go ahead.
You mentioned about Charlie Bendheim. He was with his father when this happened?
Yeah, he was.
In America?
Yeah. He was working with, we're talking the late 30s. And Charlie was working for his father. And Charlie told me he took the check to the bank. I'm quoting Charlie. Charlie said to me...
What was Charlie's father's name?
Siegfried. Siegfried Ben.
Last year in this yeshiva, there was a boy named Charlie Benham.
Yeah, last year in...
And this year, there's also one. Sam
Benham in Torah
Shraga. Torah Shraga. Tell them to say hello to me. Those are great-grandchildren. Great-grandchildren of Siegfried. They're grandchildren of Charlie, right?
Charlie's...
Or
great-grandchildren.
Are they great-great-grandchildren of Siegfried? Very nice. Happy to see Torah continues. That's from the American branch, but there's a big Israeli. So you should
know.
So Charlie Bendheim had a grandson, or has a grandson, who's a pilot in the Israeli Defense Forces. It's the son of his son, who is my student, and his wife, who is my student. And that's their son. And if this is the week of Yom Zikaron, Chag Atzmaut, we have a lot to be proud of. Yes, is there any other question? All right, I want to wish everyone a meaningful Yom HaZikaron, a very happy Chag Atzmaut. I want to thank you for honoring me with your presence. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya. And once again, I thank Yomo that I could teach today and sign off today and be a mensch today.